Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. From blogs to breaking news, memoirs to self-help books, movies to the music on your iPod, in your ear, we are living in a media-saturated world. So saturated, says our guest tonight, that our very existence and understanding of the world has become thoroughly mediated, filtered, and flattered through media representations of the self and reality. Tonight on Point, living the mediated life, lives defined by the inescapable media. But first, we begin tonight in Washington, where a new survey has been released tracking the prevalence of opinion in the nation's news reporting. Fox News sports the slogan, "We report, you decide." Not so, says the study by the Washington-based Project for Excellence in Journalism. Howard Kurtz is media columnist for the Washington Post. I asked him for the survey's headline.
The headline is that Fox News is a pretty opinionated network, which is something I suppose that a lot of people have already suspected, but now we have data. We have quantifiable numbers that show that to a far, far greater extent than the other cable networks, Fox News journalists, anchors, and reporters often inject their own opinion when reporting stories. Now, obviously, Fox's audience must like that because they've got the biggest audience in the cable news universe, but it's a very different approach than more traditional networks.
Give us some examples of what this study found.
Well, for example, last year there was a report on developments in Iraq. And a Fox News reporter said on the air that Iraq has a new interim constitution and is well on its way to democracy. "Let's pray it works out," said David Asman, the anchor, who also is a former editorial writer for the Wall Street Journal. That kind of thing crops up again and again. Now, I'm not surprised at all that on Bill O'Reilly's show, for example, 97% of the segments and interviews had opinion, usually O'Reilly's opinion. The only surprise there is that it's not 100%. But that's what O'Reilly's paid to do. He's paid to have opinions. It's in news segments and not on talk shows where Fox has maintained that it is a fair and balanced and straightforward network. And I'm not saying that this completely contradicts that, but clearly they have an approach, a philosophy, a marketing strategy that says that not only that their hosts and anchors and reporters should show some personality, but they're not shy about telling you about the way they view the news. By contrast, just to throw out some figures at you, on the Iraq War, 73%, according to this study by the Project for Excellence in Journalism, of the war-related stories on Fox News included some journalist opinion, 29% on MSNBC, and 2% on CNN.
So does this mean that the sense of what non-biased or unopinionated reporting is has changed, Howie? Is Fox adhering to a new definition, or are they simply saying, to heck with the old one?
Well, I think Fox has obviously reinvented the way you cover the news. Some people think their approach is more exciting, maybe watching a network like CNN where you get almost no inflections or interjections of opinion is not always that exciting. But also Fox is catering to its audience, and I think that one of the things that has made Fox popular, and surveys have supported this, is that a lot of people who lean toward the conservative side of the spectrum love Fox News, and a lot of people who lean toward the liberal side of the spectrum don't love Fox News, in fact resent Fox News. So they have, Roger Ailes and the other people at Rupert Murdoch Network, have injected what they see as an antidote to the generally liberal media. They would tell you, and they've told me, that ABC, CBS, NBC are biased to the liberal side. They don't acknowledge a conservative bias. They see it as balanced. But I think the one thing this study tells us is that they are not shy about sharing on-air opinions. And it just so happens, I believe, that those opinions often are the kind of opinions that their audience craves.
Howie, run us through some of the other numbers here about some of their other shows compared to cable competitors and network competitors, I guess.
Well, for example, just to stay with the war for a moment, the tone of war coverage on Fox News, 38% of the stories were positive, 20% positive on CNN, 16% positive on MSNBC. And so those who believe that Fox often appears to be a cheerleader for the Bush administration on the war have some data here that might tend to support that. On the other hand, if you look at broadcasts that most closely resemble news programs, CNN's Newsnight with Aaron Brown, about 9% opinion there. MSNBC's Countdown with Keith Olbermann, about 9% opinion there. Special Report with Brit Hume, 70% of the stories or segments of interviews have opinion. Now, I would add that that number is a little inflated by the fact that Brit Hume has an analyst panel on at the end of every show for a couple of segments, and they're supposed to give their opinions. But I think, obviously, there's more opinion than just that, or the figure would not be 70%.
How do you interpret this? Is it possible that listeners and viewers today want more analysis, and maybe opinion is what they get to scratch that itch, or is Fox simply breaking the old journalistic rule book, or both?
Well, the world has changed, and there's a million places now, including talk radio, including blogs, including news beamed to your cell phone, where you can get the headlines. So what a lot of places, and Fox is not the only one, are trying to do is to present a news product that is interesting and exciting and entertaining enough to attract an audience that is being bombarded with news and information 24 hours a day. I believe in this country that we are moving toward a red and blue media. And I'm not saying that Fox is all red, because I think they have some very good reporters there, and I'm not saying that others are all blue. But I do think that a lot of people who say, who tell pollsters that they want straightforward, unbiased news, really, when it comes down to what they do with the clicker or the radio dial or the TV set, want news that reinforces their own view of the world, that reinforces their prejudices. So you had a lot of Bush supporters who watched Fox last year during the campaign. You had a lot of Kerry supporters who gravitated to CNN or MSNBC.
Fox has done well with this strategy. You say you are expecting a red and blue media emerging. Does that mean you think others will copy Fox, will pump up the opinion level in their news programs in order to gain market share?
I don't know to what extent that will happen, but I think as the news universe fragments into more and more pieces, we see it in talk radio where there are fewer neutral programs. You're either conservative, which is most often the case on talk radio, or you're liberal like Air America. I think we're starting to see others wanting to take a more ideological, more bombastic approach. I think Fox clearly has had an impact there.
Howie Kurtz, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Howard Kurtz is media columnist for The Washington Post and host of CNN's Reliable Source. He spoke with me from Washington. Americans live in a media-soaked world. Lives shaped, sculpted, surrounded by media messages and media choices on the radio or iPod on your way to work, on your cable choice or TiVo grab at home at night. Through billboards and bestsellers and web feeds, we are increasingly defining ourselves and the world, says my guest tonight, by what we absorb through the filters and flattery of the media. This hour on Point, Living the Mediated Life. You can join the conversation. Do we all now define ourselves in terms and categories handed to us by the omnipresent media in music, in film, in ads? And how do you define authenticity in a thoroughly mediated age? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Thomas DeZengotita, contributing editor at Harper's Magazine. He teaches philosophy and anthropology at the Dalton School in New York City and at New York University. His new book is Mediated, How the Media Shapes Your World and the Way You Live in It. Thomas DeZengotita, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack. Good to have you.
Hello, Tom. Hello to our guest.
Thomas DeZengotita, so here we are. We've seen the media monster out there for a while. But you're taking us to a description of its impact that goes perhaps even deeper than many people contemplate. What exactly is the effect of the media envelope that you're describing here?
I like to think it goes deeper. And accidentally, the Howard Kurtz piece that you just had on before I came in was a perfect segue to make that point.
Accidentally or not, you know, it's a media-manipulated world.
Yeah, that's right. But, I mean, the underlying dynamic in what he was saying about dividing into red and blue media and so on, the underlying dynamic is the choice that people are making to see things, hear things, look at things that reflect themselves. And they've now got the technological wherewithal to do that. And with it, they're using it to make little me world compartments that they can live in and sort of enjoy the reflection of themselves in everything they hear about the world. And that's just one manifestation of what I call the flattered self. which I think of as being ultimately a product of media, going all the way back to print, but obviously a huge threshold was breached in the last 20 or 30 years because of the technological capacities we have. Mm. If I could just quickly, I'm sorry, just the really key point here is
yes.
That's original is that I think we're hardwired, essentially, to respond to attention. We're hardwired to respond when somebody greets us, solicits us, offends us, whatever. And that sort of ancient inclination is now being solicited and satisfied and stroked to a degree, an intensity that's just was unimaginable in earlier periods of history. And I think that's led to people feeling like little gods in the middle of their little universes. And that's the sort of core of the whole situation, although there are so many aspects.
You've got a lot of angles here. Jack Beatty, there's a lot more we want to talk about. But here's the basic premise, that we're increasingly wrapped in the cocoon that's been growing around us and our culture for years now. And Thomas DeZingatita says, in the middle of that, somehow we're changing at a fundamental level, where everything is filtered, everything is flattered, everything is a production of media.
Yeah, and you know, when I think of his view of media as against the history of the book, what strikes me is the book was interior, personal, private, and it produced a culture of criticism, I mean, from which the Reformation, Revolution, science all came. But when I think of the world given by the media, even though it has this me aspect, it's my music and so on, what strikes me about it is that it's flat, it is shallow, it does not generate the critical faculty, and it generates rather authority and obeisance, not to internal authority, not to my conscience, my sensibility, but to some external tastemaker or self-maker. And that seems to me a really scary shift.
We're going to be looking at exactly that. Jack, stand by, and Thomas DeZingatita, author of the new book, Mediated. You can join the conversation tonight. Do you buy this analysis? Are we all now helplessly products of the media? Do we all define ourselves in terms and categories handed to us by music, film, news, ads? And is this fundamentally different from old-style cultural influences, from the church, the mosque, the temple, the polka band, the quilting circle? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about lives defined by the inescapable media, about the authenticity of the self in the media age. My guest tonight, Thomas DeZingatita, his new book is Mediated, How the Media Shapes Your World and the Way You Live in It. You can join the conversation tonight. Do you buy the analysis? Have you tried to get off the grid, to pull the plug, to escape the media blob? Can it be done? And what does the media marinade do to us as humans? Is it a good thing, a bad thing? Does your every moment, your every impression feel mediated? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Thomas DeZingatita, you write about the design of Versailles, the great palace of the sun god, the king of France, and how it relates to what you're saying today. Describe that for us.
Well, I read in some book that was actually laid out purposely so that His Highness, literally, could see forever from every direction, could kind of command a view of the world.
Or at least have that impression.
Yeah, have that impression.
And it's a very strong impression when you stand behind Versailles and look out over the garden there.
Very strong, but it's nothing compared to what the average citizen of the overdeveloped world is able to look on as a matter of course and take for granted now. All of nature and all of history are striking poses just for you.
When you draw that analogy with Versailles, you suggest the limits of a mediated view of the world. I mean, Versailles might look like the universe, might be designed to feel like a perfect cosmos, but it was a teeny tiny corner. Are you saying that the mediated life is necessarily a blinkered, diminished life?
Not at all. Well, now wait a minute. Diminished, yes, in the sense that the interior that Jack was talking about earlier, he's right about that, then, at least for most people. So there's a certain diminishment in depth, let's call it. But there are innumerable enhancements as well, especially for people who otherwise don't have the kind of opportunities that educated people can take for granted.
Enhancements like what?
Well, like simply being able to make choices that they couldn't make before. I mean, I really think that the all of the progress we've made in this country and in the direction of diversity and you know, women's rights and gay rights and all of that, all if without without mediational processes behind that, representations of people's lives that that involved everyone in those kinds of changes of value, as we'd say if we were talking on the right, media is responsible for a lot of that. The kind of optionality that a mediated person is, except for the ones who choose to be niche committed and fanatic, which is an option for a mediated person, but for those who choose to surf the entire scene, they're much more open to variety and different ways of being.
So what does it mean in terms of human nature now as compared to a century or even centuries ago? You say that a lot of people are in denial about what's happening with this mediation, but and that it's crude to question that. But I want to ask you anyway.
Sure, no, go ahead. Absolutely.
How is this different from the age when everything was mediated, let's say, through the church in
yeah.
much of Europe,
yeah.
Or through local culture in a village, through the rhythm and message of the polka band?
Absolutely.
How is this different exactly?
It's very subtle, but it's very deep, and you just carefully pay attention to the difference. The difference is that in times past, let's say pre-modern and non-modern circumstances, culture was mediating reality for people, even right down to the categories of grammar and language that people
sure.
use. Culture's always mediated reality. But now we know it. And by we, I don't just mean a few privileged intellectuals. I mean the great mass of people living in the mediated sectors of the world understand that culture is a construct and that identity is something that's at least partly up to them to create. And that's completely different from the way taken-for-granted custom used to shape the roles and behaviors of people's lives. Because they didn't know it was custom, they thought it was natural. It appeared to people in traditional societies as reality. So it's the awareness that we've got now of the constructive, optional nature of our being that fundamentally makes us mediated, and that's hugely different.
Jack Beatty, what do you think? This is kind of like a nutshell definition of postmodernism here. We're aware. We know that we're creating ourselves out of all the sort of sampling and fragments we pick up on the media. Do you buy that? Do you see it as fundamentally different, Jack, from the time when religion defined the surround for so many people, when culture was the mediation?
I guess I do. I mean, it's an intensification of one of the salient characteristics of modernism, which was, the idea of choices, of you're not, are things not given to you, that you're, that the modern person is the liberated person. Tradition isn't dictating
absolutely.
His or her life.
Absolutely.
But here, not only isn't tradition not doing it, but people are aware of the forces that can do it. And, you know, it's that double conscious, it's that consciousness as well as the lack of tradition, it seems to me, that does define this this moment in that respect.
Thomas, I want to be sure we don't blow by exactly what this means and get it well defined here. You, by contrast, say, imagine that your car broke down in the middle of nowhere, maybe the middle of Saskatchewan, and you say that points up, the contrast points up what we're in the midst of now. How so?
Well, I wish I could read the passage. It's, in my humble opinion, rather well written. And it evokes, you know, the tiny little corners of our lives where we still encounter reality in relatively unmediated ways. And the argument I make is that they are usually in tiny little corners or in disasters. That's the other possibility, horrible illnesses or, you know.
Or in vast blank expanses like much of
Saskatchewan. Yes, but even then you can't just be dry. It's because you break down. It's because you just happen to be there. There's no car in sight. You have to spend. You've got, very important in that little example, is you've got no gear. No cell phone, no book, no radio, no nothing.
No gear. And what you said that caught my eye was that when you stand outside your car, before you change the tire or whatever
exactly.
You realize in a moment there in that vast expanse of Saskatchewan that none of it is for you. Nothing there is designed to affect you, unlike almost every environment that we're in these days, where the billboard, license plate surround, the iPod, everything is for you, designed to impact you.
And you can really feel that when you end up accidentally in an accidental place where things weren't designed to affect you. And at that moment, you could stumble into a bus station in Albany in a snowstorm and you have to sit there for 3 hours, you know. And you know then that what it would be like to be in a world that wasn't addressing you all the time. You'd know what it would be like to be without this deep, hardcore flattery that I'm saying underlies the whole modern. Jack's were completely right about the modern intensification of the modern thing.
I'm sure our listeners have views on this, and I want to hear them in a moment. Before we go to them, is this a good thing? Is this a bad thing? What's the consequence of this kind of mediated life?
Well, I must admit, since I wrote my first Harper's essays about this, I've been persuaded mostly by the young people I work with into seeing a lot more good in all of this than I used to.
Lay that out for us, because I think a lot of people tend automatically to say, oh, you know, we're lost in a kind of miasma of images, meaningless, means nothing. Why is it better? Why is it good?
Well, I think that's because a lot of people are still stuck in the idea that the opposite of reality is artificial or phony. And I think we've reached such a threshold of saturation with this stuff now that opposition's no longer serves much purpose. The real opposite of real now is optional. And I spell it out at length in the book. But if you think about when people say the reality is X, right?
Mm-hmm,
okay.
Mm-hmm.
When they say that, what they're saying to you is this is something you have to deal with that you have no choice about. And the vernacular is recognizing something deep in the culture when it uses that little piece of slang, as slang does that so often.
But you're saying a lot of people can just change channels and the reality changes too.
If you think of the opposite of real as being optional and you really look at your life, most people out there, let's say a handicapped person who now has the option of, you know, being able to get into places because they've got ramps and elevators.
Are you calling that media?
It's a byproduct.
Mm-hmm.
It's a byproduct of the kinds of empathetic understandings of people that I would call them the optional identities that we're surrounded with, made possible. There's a lot of really good things that happened as a result of people being reflexive about their own identities. It enabled them to understand others in a way that they never could before.
So options open up
masses of people.
Right. Options open up. And what about consequences? Beyond that empathy, what does it do to individual selves? What does it do to societies when they become creatures of media?
The flip side, the downside of this kind of optional, empathic, mediated self is that this is also a very flexible, kind of fluid self, which is able to move from attachment to attachment with an enormous facility. Once again, there are these niche committed people, fanatics, that could be in game worlds or they could be religious fanatics. That's another thing that happens under these circumstances. But for the vast majority of the blue state hipsters, there's a kind of fluidity. It's what Jack said about surface as opposed to interior. There's a kind of fluidity to the identity of a mediated person, which has a kind of commitment downside, shall we say?
Mm.
Everything that got talked about all during the 90s about youth and irony and apathy and all of that, all that's a manifestation of this of what I'm talking about.
Okay, so blue state hipsters, do you like this fluidity? Red state stolid folk, what do you think of it? Just in general, we're looking at this issue of authenticity and the self in a time when we are saturated, marinated in media. Connor's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Connor, what do you think?
Hi, well, I love the idea of the opposite of reality being an option. I'm going to, at the expense of coming off totally flat, I'd like to see if I can kind of weave that with what I was going to say.
Okay.
My spin on that would be that your option is your sense of self within all of this media that you so aptly, you know, use the word, the adjective of being marinated in it. I mean, it's almost to the point where you can sit down and watch TV without really watching anything or without really paying attention to it, and it's just kind of on and being sort of beamed into your head, the kind of sci-fi image.
But exactly.
But do you buy that it's shaping who you are, Connor? Do you buy that?
Exactly.
I do
to a certain extent. This is very, very applicable for a lot of kind of cultural things that we spend hours and years fretting about with, you know, violence in movies and media and video games.
Yep.
it is there, and it does influence you, but it is still up to your individual kind of sense of discretion as to, you know, what does this mean to me, as opposed to, oh my gosh, they said it on the TV box, it's got to be true. So
you're choosing options. And are you happy for this mediated life, Connor?
I am to a degree, but I mean, the good comes with the bad, I suppose. There's kind of a counterbalance for everything. I liked the little thought that I'm sorry, I tuned in late. I didn't catch any names, but the idea that your younger coworkers or apprentices or whatever are kind of influencing you, that, you know, that maybe this mass media thing isn't so bad after all.
They're bringing Thomas De Zengotita around. They're bringing him around. Connor, we've got it. Tom?
They're bringing me to where I am now able to recognize in the way Connor just said, to a degree, that whole way he said that. That's just so characteristic of mediated people. They're able to live with ambivalence and with sort ofs and half and halves and maybes to an extraordinary extent. And there are, as he said it beautifully, you know, there's a downside to that and there's an upside to that. The blob, which is one of the main metaphors in the book, the blob is all about both and all, you know?
And yet I can't help wondering about the kind of muffling quality of the blob. The sort of, I mean, we sneer at Muzak, but in a way, all of media becomes a kind of Muzak. Carrie's calling from Cape Cod in Massachusetts. Hi, Carrie, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show.
Sure.
I'm a journalist myself, actually, and I'm not calling in to defend journalists. I've mainly been working in foreign journalism.
Okay.
And I've recently returned to the States, and I would say we are definitely a mediated society.
Where were you coming from, and how did it feel coming back, Carrie?
I was in West Africa most recently in Ivory Coast, and I just returned almost 2 months ago now.
And how did the mediated texture of America hit you?
Well, it's the hardest thing coming into this society, I was saying, even as foreigners coming into the society, but even as an American myself, you need to be up on what the latest movie is, what the best fad is, have the coolest iPod. I mean, you have to be on top of that. And otherwise, if you start talking about other things, people just look at you like you're crazy.
Right. So the reality is all that media swirl that's around us. If you're not plugged in, you're not with the reality.
That's true. And I think the other point, though, is I think Americans are, I mean, we're a 24/7 society. We want everything here and now as fast as possible. And I think the news is catered to that. I think that people expect their news to be handed to them, and whatever they get, I mean, that's why I think it's got this biased skew to it, because they want what's convenient. They want to hear, as that your guests were saying earlier, their own beliefs reinforced, and they don't want to take the time to get on the internet or look for other outlets to find their news sources.
So they'll find the source that flatters them, flatters their sense of the world. Carrie, thanks very much for your call. Thomas De Zengotita, I wonder about that. I spent many years abroad, maybe 10 years, and each time I'd come back after a long time abroad, I'd feel a kind of resistance to re-entering that American bubble, because it's so powerful, and it looked, from the outside coming in, looked so smothering. You describe it as kind of liberating, but isn't it in a way also a kind of blanket over our heads?
Yes, absolutely. And I think even Connor, if he, you know, went on a long, extended kind of outward brown thing into nature, if he was into that sort of thing, if that was the kind of options he'd like to exercise, he'd feel the same smothering when he came back in. He'd adapt to it, as I assume you did too, Tom. I do.
You adapt after a while, but you wonder what's lost.
And a lot is lost. Yeah. A lot is lost.
Jack Beattie, how about it? Your sense of reality and options. Is there no reality that's standing behind all this media screen and just laughing?
Well, there is the reality that Whitman gives in one of the great lines of poetry: "I am the man, I suffered, I was there." There is that personal experience, authenticity, and it's harder and harder to find in a mediated world. And, you know, yes, the media does invite us to have empathy, but it's a kind of cheap empathy.
I agree.
And when I think of the way in which we can't make violence present to ourselves in any way that motivates us, that seems to me the salient aspect of the media world. And by contrast, look at one movie, Persona, Bergman's Persona. There's a woman taking care of another woman, mentally ill. She's a nurse. She's talking. Yep. She's being nice to the woman, making food. The woman, a glass drops, and we see that the good, you know, the talking, happy woman walking back and forth, and the troubled woman isn't telling her that her bare feet are going to hit that glass. Yep. And this goes on for minutes, and we
and that's a horrible moment of violence. He, and finally, we see one moment of violence that really, really gets us, and you realize how little that happens in representation.
Maybe it's all too easy just to change the channel, to look away, to go from
that's
tragedy
exactly
to comedy
right.
in a nanosecond.
That's exactly right. I wish Jack and I had more time, but I mean, I couldn't agree more with what he's saying, but I would just, I mean, just to up the ante, you know, on him a little bit. He's talking about a movie.
Right.
A great movie. Ingmar Bergman's my favorite movie right. maker, but when he was casting around in his mind for a moment of reality, he hit upon a movie.
And there we are. There we are back at it. Though you point out, ever since the ancient Greeks, I mean, what's on the stage has always been a big factor.
Oh, that... very true. Very true.
Yep, there we are. Thomas Zegontita, stand by. The new book is Mediated, How the Media Shapes Your World and the Way You Live in It. Listeners, you can join us. What is authenticity in a world of media-driven versions of the self? And if we are all mediated, what's the consequence for life, for self, for humanity? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Thomas Zegontita. His new book is Mediated, How the Media Shapes Your World and the Way You Live in It. You can join us tonight when the jukebox of media realities is so jammed, do your choices define you, define yourself. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Tony is calling from Durham, North Carolina. Hi, Tony. You're on the air.
Hey, how are you?
Great, thanks.
This whole discussion reminds me of a book, a science fiction novel in the 70s called Stand on Zanzibar by John Brunner, where you'd be watching, one of the technological innovations was you'd be watching a man on the street interviewed, but your image would be grafted onto that person. So in a sense, you'd be watching yourself give an opinion in a man on the street interview.
So everybody interviewed was you.
That's right. So you'd be sucked. So that was the slogan of the newscast where the opinion is from you. And so you were totally sucked into that, and also the opinion was kind of manipulated by the corporation. But this whole thing reminds me eerily of that whole scenario.
Tony, do you think we're that close to that kind of sci-fi reality? And what are the consequences if we are? How do you judge it?
Oh, I think we're very close. I mean, I think your panelists there can speak to that probably better than I can. But I think we're extremely close with all this interactive media and the internet and. Scanning digital imagery, things like that. I mean, we can already do things with digital imagery.
Just throw cloning into the mix, and you're really
throw right. cloning in. You've got it, Tony. Thanks for your call. Yeah, yeah. Thomas Zegontita, you say imagine a time when instead of raising a child, you're raising a clone of yourself. You say imagine the soccer sidelines when that day
right.
arrives,
and
quote unquote parents are cheering for younger cloned versions of themselves.
Imagine that.
Now, why is that an outcome of the sort of media age you describe? Why might it
be? Well, that particular part of the book is really a kind of over the top satirical riff.
Yeah.
But it is meant to point to a cultural logic about the flattered self developing. Look, man, I didn't make this up. Clones are a result of the manipulation of codes, just the way digital representations manipulate codes. They're all about information. It's a different platform. Instead of a silicon platform, you've got a, organic chemical platform. And a clone is, if you can't call it a representation of yourself, I mean, what is it? So I just couldn't help but notice how neatly that whole development kind of fell into the categories I developed when I was thinking about representations of other sorts.
The flattery grows, the self-regard grows, and the next thing you know,
incredible.
you're cheering on your clone on the soccer field. Let's get another call.
I'm sorry.
Oh, yes, please, Thomas.
I just want, he made this point about the man in the street interviews, and I often find that it helps people to understand just how different things are now from what they were even 40 years ago. If you think of the average sort of interview with a normal citizen that you might see in a 50s documentary or something, the incredible awkwardness with which an ordinary person not accustomed to being on stage showed when they were speaking into a microphone or into a camera, the just riveted, kind of stiff, formal, uncomfortable.
They're not ready to strike the Anchorman cool pose.
They can't. But now, if you know, there's a snowstorm and the transit breaks down in a big city or whatever, and the people go out in the streets and do interviews, the normal people in a car on a subway platform, they're completely cool. They can talk totally naturally. They look at the camera. They look at the interviewer. Right. They make funny jokes. They're completely comfortable.
They've seen it all before.
And they've been it.
Right. They've been it, at least in their mind's eye. Yeah. Bill's calling from Framingham, Massachusetts. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
How are you doing? I guess one of the things that has been mystifying to me over the last 4 years in particular under the Bush administration is seeing the manipulation of media, news, and quote-unquote reality. And I was wondering to what degree your guests think that people have become numb to the content, the substance of news, and have essentially focused on imagery, the smiling face that is revealing shift of wealth from the poor to the wealthy.
So the smiling face or the menacing threat or whatever image is put up at the moment by the political player. Bill, it's a great issue. Thomas Sengatita, how about it? How about the impact on politics, democracy? Yeah. There was a lot of talk last year about the way in which when the media can present any kind of image, then any image gains equal credibility in some sense, whether it's at all factual or not.
Yeah, that's true. And that's part of the what I call in the book the moreness of everything and its numbing effect. That word's actually used.
So what happens to democratic politics?
Well, in general, my response to this question is that other writers, you know, Todd Gitlin, Tom Frank, have done a tremendous job of talking about the media from that point of view. And in the book, I agree completely with all of that. But I don't have much original to say about it beyond what Tom and Todd have said.
Well, they're not with us tonight, so give us your slant on it, though, because anyone who's listening is thinking, well, the idea is citizens are supposed to contemplate reality and, you know, to the best of their wisdom and insight, have a view and act on it with a vote at least.
I guess I would say that being that kind of a citizen is an option, which many people, I think, you know, people who didn't support Bush, although there's a sort of neoconservative kind of bow-tied Yale intellectual who observes their citizenship thing. You know, that
absolutely.
Whole way, you know, they take their citizenship just as seriously as anyone.
But they take it from a different channel on cable.
Yes, that's all. It's the tragic thing I would say is that being a serious citizen in this great flood of images which all kind of neutralize each other and equalize each other out in the way the caller described, being a responsible citizen who really thinks about policy and cares about decisions in that sort of way and forms themselves in that traditional way, that's an option that some people exercise and most people don't.
An option that may look antique. Let's turn to Lexington, Kentucky, and Victoria. Hi, Victoria, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Some of the points that I wanted to make, well, I guess were already mentioned by a previous caller and by your guests just recently. But
so give us your best shot now. What are you left thinking, Victoria?
Okay. I'm a student, and I do like to participate in the life of the polity, you know, the life in Lexington, Kentucky.
Sure.
And one of the ways for me to do that is to read the newspapers, to listen to the news, to listen to the radio, as in this case. And I don't mind so much being mediated as much as I am afraid that, you know, people are going to be manipulating me and, you know, giving me only what they want me to see rather than, you know, the full story and let me make up my own mind about, you know, what's good about it, what's bad, and how I want to act on that information.
So go ahead, mediate me, but be honest, be responsible about it. That's a big tool to hand someone, Victoria.
Yes, and you know, I just want to make sure that you know, our journalists and people who are responsible for that are indeed, you know, people of integrity and honesty, and they are doing their best. I don't want somebody to lie, you know, in my face. I want them to say, okay, you know, we made a mistake. we apologize, you know, let's correct it and let's move on.
It would seem to matter more than ever when reality itself is being shaped. Victoria, thanks for your call. Jack Beatty, how about it? It's exactly what everyone wants to ask of the media when it's painting the mural that surrounds us, but it's also, we've seen, a lot to ask. It does not come close to always happening.
No, it doesn't. And the instance of Fox News, of which we began, is an example, mm-hmm. a flagrant example of misreporting. I mean, studies showed that, you know, outsized percentages of Fox viewers believe things about the Iraq war that simply were not factually so.
Oh,
for example,
huge
that we
numbers.
Found weapons of mass destruction. Yeah. Well, that is propaganda, and that's what an earlier caller was raising. The way the mediated world is sort of the fog of propaganda. It's there. It's all the techniques are out there, and this administration, other administrations use them. But what makes this administration, I think, so effective, what did was it had fear to go on. You know, it played on fear because people were afraid.
That's true.
That respect, every time someone showed yet another terrorist outrage, yet another reprise of the Twin Towers going down, that made people feel, we need Mr. Bush. We need a man who's strong.
So when an honest representation, whatever that may mean in this kind of postmodern reality you're describing, Thomas Ingatit, when you can't count on that, where does a person find their footing, their grounding in the mediated world?
Just to add one point to what Jack said, in addition to what he said, the other thing the Bush administration had going for it is that they were completely aware that winning political campaigns has nothing to do with what reality is and has only to do with the reality you can create.
Mm-hmm.
And to the extent that the Democrats have been clumsy in opposition to Bush, it's because most of them still partly believe that at least something you say ought to have something to do with reality.
And our caller Victoria wants that. She's saying
exactly.
She's mediate me, but give me the truth. How do you find that grounding?
And I think you could hear it in her voice. I mean, she's going to have to find it for herself. She's going to have to go around, look for reliable sources, quote the name of a show. It's up to her. It's up to her.
It's a tall order when, as you say, there's a channel trying to flatter everyone.
Yeah, that's
we're all
right.
susceptible to being flattered into thinking that the most comfortable version of reality is the true.
Exactly. This is a challenge for the traditional notion of citizenship, unlike any that we've ever operated under.
Okay, Jack, the jukebox is stuffed with options here, and we're being told that options, options are realities too. I mean, the options are the new reality. Are you ready to swing in that jungle, Jack?
Well, you know, what keeps coming to my mind is a line people are reviving of Senator Moynihan's, which is everyone is entitled to his own opinion, not to his own facts. And that is what seems to be happening. People now seem to be entitled to their own tailor-made, prejudice-adjusted facts.
That's right.
That's really that is new territory, it seems to me.
It's new territory, and it's really true what he's saying. I mean, it's just people just don't care what the facts are. I mean, the people that who are playing the game, let's put it that way, they just grab them. I mean, you know, whatever works.
But you get the feeling, at least I do, that there is still a reality out there that's made of, you know, carbon. And there's an environmental reality. There's a kind of cosmic reality of, I don't know, an asteroid out there somewhere with our name on it. I mean, it is not all the next flip of the channel.
No.
Well, we'll be waiting. Thomas DeZingatita, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
It's my pleasure, by the way. Your characterization of the book has been unusually good. Thank you.
We're glad to do it. And Jack, thanks so much for being with us.
All right. Thank you.
Thomas DeZingatita, his new book is Mediated, How the Media Shapes Your World and the Way You Live in It. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, the downside of listening to MP3 players in public. This is On Point. Thank you. On Point producer Meghna Chakrabarty recently joined the ranks of the millions of Americans who own personal MP3 players. Now she can take her favorite tunes with her wherever she goes, but she's found that having her own personal soundtrack follow her around has a downside.
I'm here outside in Boston because this is a story that takes place outside. I've been lucky enough to be able to walk to work every day for about 3 years now. It's an 18-minute ramble that I never really thought much about until yesterday, when for the first time I took my brand new iPod Shuffle out on a test run. The iPod was a gift from my brother and something that I coveted for a really, really long time. So I loaded it up with music, about 240 different songs off my computer, put those white Apple earbuds in my ears, pressed play, and headed out the door. And for the first time in 3 years, my daily walk to work went from this to this. From this to this. My iPod, my music, the soundtrack to my life, and it kind of freaked me out. The sonic dimension of the world vanished. The trees, the cars, the dogs, the sirens, everything that I was used to hearing every day on my walk from work, all silenced. It all went flat and felt a million miles away, like being plunged suddenly into a strange underwater world, like being the plastic figurine inside a snow globe. All the sounds of the world, you know, like parents pushing toddlers in strollers, people shoveling snow off the sidewalks, kids just waiting for the bus. It had all been replaced by a screeching 1979 track from The Police, which, though I love, now it just doesn't really seem to make any sense at all. I began to think that having my entire environment, everything, be a reflection of me and of, you know, my preferences and my particular tastes is not such a great thing, actually, because, oh, whoa, there's that catbird. There's, you know, I walk past this spot every day, and the male bird just sings and sings, and I didn't think they'd be singing right now. That's the kind of thing I missed out on yesterday when I was walking to work with The Police and The Clash blasting in my ears. So it felt like by cutting myself off from the world, even though I was listening to music that I wanted, was like putting myself in a hall of mirrors. And suddenly I felt kind of small and adrift and isolated and alone. But from now on, I'm not going to walk to work with my iPod anymore. I'll keep it in my pocket and I'm going to walk to work and I'm just going to listen and to experience the sounds and surprises in that world. I don't know. It's something that feels precious. It's something that feels rare. And it's something to me that feels really beautiful.
Meghna Chakrabarty is a producer for On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.